Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Iran sentences an American to death. Egypt votes again. So much democracy there now. Here at home, White House Chief of Staff Bill Daley resigns after less than a year, fed up with Washington rancor. Luckily, we have New York Times Chief Washington Correspondent and WNYC contributor David Sanger here to take us from D.C. to Tehran to Cairo, where he is right now. David, welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be with you, Brian.
So we were just talking before the news about the beautifully warm January that you're missing here in the eastern United States. Do they ever talk about global warming in Cairo?
You know, you would talk about global warming in Cairo, but in order to see it or feel it, you'd have to get out from under the smog of the traffic and everything else that envelops the city. So my guess is that this is a pretty big carbon producer, is my sense from walking around.
It is one of the, you know, incredibly dense traffic cities of the world, isn't it?
It is. I was trying earlier this afternoon to go over to a voting area where Jimmy Carter was actually going to show up and talk about voting in Egypt. Interesting, given his history. Of course, is the one who helped negotiate the Israeli-Egyptian peace accord. And it was supposed to be 20 minutes away, and we gave up after about an hour and a half.
We will come back to Cairo and talk about the voting there and whether the series of wins for the Muslim Brotherhood will continue and what that means. But let's go to Washington for the first real part of our conversation with the resignation of Bill Daley, almost a year to the day after he took over for Rahm Emanuel. Bill Daley, son of former Chicago Mayor Richard Daley, who once punched a guy in a toy store after arguing about politics in a toy store, leaves Washington because he thinks Washington has gotten too nasty. What does that say about the perspective of rancor in D.C.?
Well, you know, there's always a moment where you think we can't hit a new low or a new measure of low, and this may be it. I think that Mr. Daley's issues may have been as much internal in the White House as external. You know, he used to be Commerce Secretary during the Clinton administration. He's worked in banking. And the theory when he came in, and he replaced Rahm Emanuel, who went on, of course, to win the mayor's post in Chicago, was that he would be a figure who would be much more acceptable to the business community. He, you know, knew that world well, had emerged from it. They liked him as Commerce Secretary a lot, and he had spent a lot of time, as I said, in the banking world since that time. It didn't turn out that way. It turned out that the business community turned more against President Obama, and it turned out that internally, I think, it seemed pretty clear that Mr. Daley found the White House, these power centers, and Congress to be an increasingly frustrating place to be. And as I've run into him a few times in the past couple of months, he did not sound like a happy man. He sounded like a man eager to return to Chicago.
So was this a failure of Daley or just politics out of his control? Because he was brought in as a bit of an antidote to Rahm Emanuel, who was considered the consummate Capitol Hill mover and shaker. But Daley was never able to make nice with Harry Reid in the way they had hoped, John Boehner with the way they had hoped, the business community, as you were just saying, in the way that they had hoped. So was it his failure or was it just an impossible task?
I think it may have been a little bit of both, and I think that coming into an administration, a very closed kind of White House like the Obama White House, after you've not been on the campaign and the searing experiences of that, you haven't been an insider for a long time, I think that it's a very difficult thing to do, and the character of this administration is difficult to do. And this is a president who does not reach out very easily, doesn't reach out to members of Congress himself. So that's one of the reasons the chief of staff has got to go do it more often. But also has a very closed circle of advisors and does not feel terribly comfortable expanding that world very much. And it's not clear to me that Bill Daley, even though he was in and out of the Oval Office, you know, many times a day, that he ever fully managed to pierce those inner circles of Obama confidants.
And we hear from Republicans all the time that Obama does not reach out, that if he came into office being the president who was going to be postpartisan, even though the Republicans refuse to play along on the big issues and the Republicans have to take responsibility for that, that he doesn't reach out on a regular basis. He doesn't try to have coffee or meetings, you know, informal get-togethers at the White House or whatever it is that would build relationships and build trust with the lawmakers on the other side of the aisle in D.C. Is it your observation as chief Washington correspondent that that's true and that that's different from other recent presidents?
Yeah, it absolutely is true. I'll tell you first about on the Congress side, and then what I see more often, which is the press side of it as well. I think it's sort of two sides of the same coin. On the side for Congress, here's a president who plays golf just about every Saturday or Sunday. He tries not to miss a weekend if he can. And yet he usually plays golf with the same small group of White House friends, insiders, gentleman who runs some of the travel operations. He doesn't use it as a moment, usually, to invite out political allies or political adversaries and chat them up in a most informal way. In fact, you remember one of the few times he did when he had played a round of golf with John Boehner. It was a huge news story because he'd done it. And the most interesting thing, I think, would be if it hadn't been a news story because he did things like that every week or every couple of weeks.
So why doesn't he do more of that? Is he just a misanthrope, or what's the reason?
I think this is more personality than anything else. I really do. I think that it's one of the areas where he can be a quite brilliant speech giver. He can be a very persuasive person in argument. He's a very intellectual, very cerebral person, but I think that he is a bit shy when it comes to this kind of thing. And we see this a little bit with the press. I mean, George Bush was not known for his great relationship with the White House press corps, and those were back in the days when I was White House correspondent for the Times. But he never missed an opportunity in the summer when you were down in Waco or even some events at the White House where he had either background or off-the-record barbecues, whatever, come back often in Air Force One and talk. Although Bill Clinton actually came back in Air Force One much more, I think, than either President Obama or President Bush has. You've not seen that take place with this president either. And on the one hand, maybe that's not a bad thing, because every time reporters show up at something like that, we're always accused of being spun, and certainly that's part of the effort of a White House. But it is interesting that you just don't see that happen very much.
David Sanger, Chief White House Chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times, my guest on WNYC. And let's travel the 6,340 miles from Washington, D.C. to Tehran and talk about the 28-year-old Iranian-American Amir Hekmati, who was sentenced to death by the Iranian military yesterday after being accused of being a spy. How serious a development is this, David, as far as you could tell, in terms of relations between the two countries? And was he a spy?
I don't know if he was a spy. He seems to have served in the U.S. military, and it would not be unusual for intelligence services to recruit some from former military, but there are a lot of former military, obviously, who don't go on into the intel world. So I can't answer the question. I do think it's interesting that when the Iranians arrested those three hikers who've all since been released for stepping into Iranian territory, or so Iran contended, they said that they were all spies. And the State Department came out right away and said that at least several of them, maybe all of them, had never worked for the U.S. government. Now, obviously, in his case, he's been in the military. They couldn't go say that. But
Do they say what? Mr. Hekmati grew up in Flagstaff, Arizona, in Flint, Michigan.
Right.
And was in the military, as you said. Is there a U.S. position on what he was doing in Iran?
I think think his family has said that he was visiting his grandmother. You know, how true that is or not, I don't know.
And even if he was a spy...
However, I do find that the sentence is pretty fascinating.
That's just what I was going to say. Even if he was a spy, countries are not sentencing each other spies to death.
That's right. That's the unusual step here in a court system that is not exactly known for its independence. And that may be that the Iranians at this point are trying to create a bargaining chip. You'll remember that there was an arrest of an Iranian-American in the U.S. a few months ago for allegedly trying to execute a plot by the Quds Force, which is part of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, to kill the Saudi ambassador to the United States. I wouldn't be shocked if the Iranians try to strike some kind of swap deal that involves him or somebody else being held by the U.S. in return for this former military.
And this, of course, comes in the context of fears over Iranian nuclear development. You reported this week on a new plant that is enriching uranium. What do we know about that plant and its purposes?
Well, here's what we know. Iran has been enriching uranium for a fairly long time at a place called Natanz, which was an underground plant, but not a very well-defended one and not a very deep one, that was revealed in 2003 by an Iranian dissident group. And their intel was right on. And eventually Iran had to open up that plant to international inspectors, and they've been going there. And that's where Iran has been doing almost all of its enrichment work. 2 years ago, in September of 2009, a little more than 2 years ago, President Obama and President Sarkozy of France and the then Prime Minister of Great Britain, Gordon Brown, all announced the discovery of an additional plant, the one that we're discussing today, that was under construction deep underground outside the city of Qom, a holy city in Iran, and very well defended because it was in a mountain and surrounded by anti-aircraft guns. The assumption at the time that the administration made was that by revealing the existence of the plant, Iran would basically have to abandon it. And for a year or so, it looked like that may be the case. But now they have actually begun installing centrifuges. And while it doesn't add too dramatically to their capability, it does add dramatically to their ability to defend against any possible kind of air attack, because this would be a very difficult plant to take out. It's one of the reasons the Israelis have said that opening up this plant would be crossing for them a major red line.
I want to play a clip of Ron Paul from one of the debates over the weekend, Saturday's debate on ABC, talking about why relations should have been a little better with Iran this week, and perhaps why some people are surprised that Iran at least chose this moment to announce a death sentence against an American. Listen.
You know, something happened this week I thought was so encouraging, and it reminds me of how we finally talked to the Chinese. I mean, they had killed 100 million of their own people, but we finally broke the ice by playing ping pong. But today, the American Navy picked up a bunch of fishermen, Iranian fishermen, that had been held by the pirates and released them. And they were so welcome. It was just a wonderful thing to happen. This is the kind of stuff we should deal with, not putting on sanctions.
So briefly, and we know, you know, Ron Paul's position generally that the U.S. is the aggressor in the relationship with Iran, but I think he told that story accurately about the U.S. at sea, the Navy picking up a bunch of fishermen who had been held by pirates, Iranian fishermen. So is rescuing fishermen in Iran the new playing ping pong with the Chinese?
Well, it was certainly an interesting gesture, and I'm not sure that it was entirely intentional, because it wasn't clear to me that the U.S. Navy knew that the Iranians had been held by this group until they interrupted an attack the pirates were doing, you know, in process, and then followed to the mothership, and then were alerted by the Iranians aboard, who spoke over a ship radio in Urdu to an American sailor who spoke Urdu. So that was an interesting moment. The Iranian response to it was even more interesting, which was the Iranian said this was a very good humanitarian gesture, And then they proceeded after that to issue the death sentence that we were just discussing.
Exactly.
So it isn't clear to me that any outreach that this might have triggered had much great benefit.
And just one more thing on Iran, because I think that the Iranian-related topic that's been most on people's lips recently is its threat to close the Strait of Hormuz to other oil-bearing traffic if the sanctions get any worse on Iran. And the price of oil has been going up in response to even that chatter, even if they're not considered very serious about it. But U.S. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner is in China today to discuss furthering the sanctions on Iran. He's expected to press the Chinese government to reduce their oil imports from Iran. So is China a key to having sanctions have an effect? And how serious do you think this Iranian threat is to close off that strait?
Well, China is key to this, Brian, and Secretary Geithner has made pretty clear that his biggest concern with China, he doesn't think he's going to get the Chinese to stop buying Iranian oil. But what he wants to do is make sure that if others stop buying Iranian oil, the Chinese don't then just step in and buy what others are not purchasing and basically undo the benefits of these sanctions. The effort by the United States and by the Europeans is not to entirely choke off Iran's ability to export oil. I don't think they think that could be successful, but to reduce its exports enough that they actually have to sell oil at a discount, which would go pretty much to the heart of the regime and may explain why the Iranians are issuing threats like closing the Strait of Hormuz. Now, could they close it? You ask people in the U.S. Navy, people who've gained this out, this has been fought through enormously, as you can imagine, by the Navy, and their answer is, yes, they can close it very briefly. They can't close it once the Fifth Fleet gets there. And they seem to know it. And I think that the most the Iranians could do, though, shipping.
Uh-huh. What do you mean once the Fifth Fleet gets there? You mean the U.S. would shoot its way in?
What the U.S. would do is what you've seen happen just during the Iranian military exercises, which is that they would just cruise the aircraft carrier and its escort ships right through the middle of the Gulf. Through the straits, and do it with significant air power overhead. And then it would be up to the Iranians about whether they would attempt to fire on a ship going through what is international waters. These are not Iranian waters. And the U.S. has said that one of its red lines is it's going to keep the strait open. And it's been extraordinarily clear, and you've heard Secretary Panetta say that the strait will remain open whatever it takes.
So you think Tehran will not challenge that position, but that they could do what, were you beginning to say, harass oil-bearing ships?
Yes. And think about the things they can do. They have a lot of small, fast boats. They can harass some shipping that's going through. They could shoot off missiles. They've got a lot of missiles on the shore there and some on these boats. They could aim some missiles at refineries nearby, Saudi refineries, other refineries. Any of those things would spook the oil markets enough to probably send the price of oil up quite dramatically. The biggest fear I hear in the Pentagon and the White House is that some kind of action like that could lead to sort of an accidental conflict in which some Iranian captain goes a bit too far, takes a pot shot at an American ship, then the rules of engagement sort of swing into action automatically and somebody shoots back and you're off to the races. And one of the big questions is, if that happened, would the U.S. or Israel or other powers in the area stop at keeping the strait open, or would they use the moment to go much further and perhaps take out some of the nuclear facilities? I don't think the U.S. would do that. The Israelis might.
David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. And we went the 6,000-plus miles from D.C. to Tehran. Now let's go the additional 1,233 miles from Tehran to Cairo, where you actually are today. Egyptian elections are continuing this week. It's not only voting day in New Hampshire, it's voting day in Cairo, and we're starting to get a sense of what Parliament is going to look like, aren't we?
We sure are, and Parliament is going to look like a pretty Islamist place. We don't have final results yet, and for the next 2 days there are sort of the cleanup runoff elections, and so the numbers are still firming up. But it seems very likely that the Muslim Brotherhood is going to get probably just shy of 50% of the seats, and that another 20 or 25% could go to the Salafis, who are a much more hardline fundamentalist Islamic group. But what's interesting is when you get out and talk to voters here and you say, so why are all of these Islamist parties winning when they had nothing to do with Tahrir Square? They weren't the ones who were out there getting rid of Mubarak. That was the students, liberals, people who really don't stand with the Islamists at all. And their answer is, it really has very little to do with religion. It has to do with the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood's been around for 80 years, that it's built up big political networks in many villages and towns outside of Cairo, and then in many neighborhoods inside Cairo. And Cairo's got about 25 million people out of a country of 85 million. And that as a result, they were voting for their friends. They were voting for people who they thought had an economic package. You don't hear much discussion of the votes for these groups, particularly the Muslim Brotherhood, being on a religious basis.
Let's play two brief clips from Saturday's debate. Newt Gingrich was the only one to bring up the Muslim Brotherhood by name. This was part of a larger critique of Obama's Middle East strategy.
You have the Muslim Brotherhood winning the elections in Egypt. The truth is we don't know who's in charge in Libya. You have a region-wide crisis.
And Rick Santorum followed up with this.
That's right. We need someone who has a strong vision for the region, and we have not had that with this president. He has been making mistakes at every turn in Iran, in Egypt, I would argue Libya, Syria, Israel. All of these places, he has made mistakes on the ground that have shown the people in that region that we are the weak horse.
So those are the Gingrich and Santorum positions from the ABC debate on how Obama is managing the Middle East. I don't know if you heard Santorum say on one of the Sunday morning shows a few weeks ago, in effect, that he doesn't even recognize the Egyptian elections as democratic because the victors, the Muslim Brotherhood, aren't democratic, in his opinion. So how much do you think things would change if one of these guys is elected president?
Well, I think they would probably discover what President Obama and President Bush before him discovered, which is that the American ability to influence the outcome of these elections, even if the U.S. wanted to, and messing with free elections is, you know, a dangerous business in the best of times, is quite limited. You know, you forget that the ouster of Mubarak here, President Mubarak, who while all these elections were going on, his trial was proceeding yesterday, and the prosecutors are seeking the death penalty against him. This wasn't about us. You know, the signs out in Tahrir Square were not about the United States. And I think one has to ask the question, to what degree does the United States want to get in and meddle with the internal elections of a country, even a country that's been a close ally? And how would the United States view it if Egypt or other Islamic countries were meddling with American elections? And you sort of have to ask the question in reverse. I don't think there's anything the United States could have done to affect the outcome of these elections, except that the U.S. had pretty poor outreach to the Muslim Brotherhood prior to this. When Secretary Clinton was here last summer, she didn't meet with them, in part because they're considered pretty radioactive in the U.S. Congress. The Muslim Brotherhood covers out an incredibly wide range of views, some of which many Americans would find completely abhorrent, and some, you know, are in the world of Islamic politics, not that extreme. I went over to the Muslim Brotherhood headquarters, political headquarters, the other day with my colleagues, David Kirkpatrick, who's our bureau chief here, and Tom Friedman, our columnist, and we spent some time talking to one of the leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood group, and you know, he had the talking points out that were exactly what Washington wanted to hear. You know, we're not sitting here trying to come up with a social agenda to change the nature of Egypt or the rights of women or so forth. We've got big economic problems. IMF is coming in here in a couple of weeks.
But do you believe it?
We've got huge deficits.
But do you believe it?
The interesting question is, do the leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood, even if they believe what they've said to us, can they enact it? Because they may need the help of the Salafists, the Salafi parties, the right-wing parties, in order to create a solid majority in the parliament. And the price of that may be pulling the Muslim Brotherhood further to the right. It is true, however, that the interesting experiment going on here is the creation of a democracy in a country that does not have oil revenues of any significant nature. And that means they need to rely on tourism and globalization. And so you're going to see the collision of the economic interest to create a pretty open country that still brings in tourists and that doesn't harass them for drinking in the hotels and being in bikinis in the, on the beaches, and the fundamentalist instincts of some of these parties.
Fascinating. David Sanger, Chief Washington Correspondent for The New York Times and WNYC contributor in Cairo today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian. Great to be with you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, still to come this hour, a labor dispute wrapped in an artistic dispute at the New York City Opera, and John Huntsman's important closing argument that the media forgot to cover. It's about trust in America. Stay with us. Now, listeners, remember that we're gathering your answers to the question, if you were giving the State of the Union address, what would you tell the country? Kids, adults, everyone, answer that question for us. And the Story Pirates, the theater group, are going to turn it into a musical to be performed at our State of the Union watching party in the green space 2 weeks from tonight. You'll want to take part in this cool project. Find out how at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show.